of the reign of Joash that Joel the prophet ministered. Now, this supposition is based upon, first of all, looking at the language and style in the book itself, in the original. It fits right with what we know to be the language and style of the Hebrew language of that period. There's a smoothness and a fluency in the rhythms, and a roundness in the sentences, and a regularity in their parallelisms, and it's very simple, very vivid language. Number two, because he does not mention a king in the book. Now, this is an argument based on silence, but it's based on silence because Joash, if you'll recall from historical books, ascended the throne at the ripe old age of 6 or 7, and basically it was a caretaker administration until he reached his majority, as he was pretty much under the oversight of the high priest Jehoiada. And so that may answer why there is no king mentioned in the book.
Because he was king in name only.
Number three, the enemies of Israel, as perceived during the time of this book, are not the nations of Assyria and Babylonia, but rather are the smaller nations of Phoenicia and the Philistines and the Egyptians. That's not necessarily a smaller nation, but it's not Assyria or Babylonia. And the Edomites. Of course, we met them in Obadiah. Put here chapter 3, verses 4 and 19. Now, this is significant because, of course, historically we know that it was not until the 8th century B.C., not the 9th century where we are here with Joel, but the 8th century B.C., or the 700s, that Assyria ascended to power. And then it was not until the 7th century B.C., or the 600s, that Babylonia came to power. And that these two nations then would have been mentioned as Israel's enemies. And so the fact that they're not mentioned bespeaks an earlier period of time when these nations that I mentioned were plaguing Israel. Number four, and last, because the presupposition in this book is that even though Israel was, they had some problems and there was sin in the nation, yet they still were worshiping Yahweh. In other words, there's no mention of idol worship. And again, Jehoiada, the high priest, a man of God, restored the true worship of Yahweh during the beginning of Joash's administration, right when he ascended the throne, in fact, and put all of the idolatrous Baal worship out of the land. Here we have 2 Kings 11, 17 and following, and 2 Chronicles 23, 16 and following. So that would fit, again, with this particular reign. Now, what about the man, Joel? Here again, we have a compound name, Joel. And Joe is anglicizing the word Yah. So it's actually Yah-El, or as we would say, Yah is El. And so here's the contraction for the name of God. Yahweh is El. And of course, El is one of the title names of God, meaning the Mighty One. So Yahweh is the Mighty One, is the meaning of Joel's name. And I believe this truth is expressed in a particular verse in the book, namely in chapter 3 and verse 17, we read, "So shall you know that I am Yahweh your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain, and then shall Jerusalem be holy, and there shall no strangers pass through here anymore." Now, I'm not saying the exact form of the word is found there. In fact, it's probably here, Yahweh your Elohim, not Yah is El. But the same basic truth. And you'll often find this with the prophets, that the meaning of their name and the truth that you would get from it, some place or places in the book will be expressed, and I think we'll find that in a number of occasions. Now, this is a common name. That is, there are other men in the Old Testament who bore the same name. There's one in 1 Samuel 8:2, for example, and there's another Joel in 1 Chronicles 4:35. And of course, they did not have surnames in ancient times as we do today, and so in order to keep from being confounded with another individual of the same name, they would say son of, and then give their father's name. And so this man is identified in Joel 1:1 as Joel, the son of Pethuel. And so he is Joel ben Pethuel, ben meaning son of in the Hebrew. Pethuel means man of God, or possibly sincerity of God. Now, other than his name, his father's name, we really know nothing about his personal life. We're not given any glimpses of it. In the three chapters of this brief book, all we have are some prophecies that the Lord gave him, some very remarkable ones. My guess is that he is from Judah, the southern kingdom. And that my reasoning is based upon the fact that he does not mention Israel, the northern kingdom, even though, again, Israel was still in existence during this time, because looking at our dates, 830 to 820, Israel didn't go into captivity by the Assyrians until 722. So Israel was still going to remain a nation for about another century. So they were around, but they are not really mentioned in this book, but Judah is, and Jerusalem and the temple and so forth. So we could speculate that perhaps that's where he's from. In any case, that's to whom he's ministering, particularly. All right, the book itself. Let's talk about that. I believe the theme of the book of Joel to be the day of the Lord cometh. So the day of the Lord is a major aspect of this book, and of course you're doing an assignment on that. You should be working on that little by little as you go, because I guarantee you, without any reservation at all, that if you wait till the last day or two or three before it's due, you're not going to get it done, or you're not going to do it right. It's going to be one of those miracle wonders, you know, just add water, or just add coffee and staying up till 4 a.m, 3 nights in a row. You'll be a wreck, and so will your grade. So, a word of warning to the wise. Give yourself plenty of time to be working on that puppy, because it takes you some time to get it done. Yes, Spirit of the Lord came upon the professor. Notice the pro beginning of it there. To fest beforehand. Now, let me see. Do we have outlines? Did I pass out outlines of the minor prophets? Okay, do you have them, boys and girls? Okay, those who have them, whip them out, because this is where we look at the outline for Joel. I did, and they are indeed the ones that I use. So even though they're simple, I know, very basic, but I like them that way usually, because it's easier to get a handle on the book than if they break down every single verse. I believe Baxter breaks the book down into three parts, doesn't he? An alarm, an appeal, an annex. Okay, so three-part book. It starts out with an alarm, and by that, it doesn't mean a fire alarm, but remember how they would blow a trumpet, and there would be a warning that would be sounded to the people of some invading army. In this case, the invasion happens to be an army of locusts. It's a locust plague that is described in the first part of the book, chapter 1:1 to 2:11, as you see there. And that is further broken down by J. Sidlow into the present desolation. He describes what it looks like in his day with the way they were just decimating the crops. And then B, the future threat. In other words, he moves into a prophecy that has as its springboard their present-day locust invasion. And, of course, that prophecy is involving the Battle of Armageddon. And then part two, an appeal. In other words, based upon the present desolation and the future threat, God appeals to his people to repent and rend their hearts and not their garments and to weep before him and so forth. It's what we call an 11th hour hope. In other words, it's pretty much a last opportunity there. We see the appeal, part A, turn ye to me, God says. That's the idea of repenting, turning from sin and toward God. And then he gives a promise that if they will return, he, future tense, will restore. And that's where you get into those wonderful latter rain promises about restoring all the years of the locust and the cankerworm and the palmer worm and the caterpillar, the day of destruction they've wrought, and the vats will overflow with wine, and the people with oil and corn and so forth. Then part three, an annex. You know, an annex is something that's added. Now, I don't think he means another author because he's pretty conservative, but he just means it's kind of tacked on in the sense that it's additional information that's somewhat overlaps what you've seen. Annex on the latter days, epics of the end time and the ultimate glory in Zion. And again, a lot of Armageddon scriptures in that section too, but remember how I've indicated one of the phenomenons of the prophets being that they'll give you a prophecy one, and then in prophecy two, they'll go back over this same basic event, but it'll be stated a little bit differently. It'll be from a different angle, maybe. So this we'll see the Battle of Armageddon two or three different ways in the book of Joel, just stated a little bit differently from a different angle. All right, that's the outline then. Any questions on the intro before we get into the book? All right. Let's turn then to Joel 1:1. Yes. No, it's prose, but even in Hebrew prose, you still have parallelisms, what I call prophetic parallelisms instead of poetic parallelisms. It's the same phenomenon where something will be stated in line one, and then the theme will be picked up again in line two, all of which may be in the same verse in an English version, and in line, but separated only by a semicolon usually. And it'll be added to, amplified on, contrasted to, or somehow it'll bounce off what is said in line one, in line two, and subsequent lines, sometimes all the way up to octuplets. You don't usually see it quite that long. The more common length is couplets or triplets, two or three lines for parallelism. So you have that even in prose. And you have lots of figures of speech and so forth. And that's just really a mark of the Hebrew language itself. It's a very simple language. It's got a relatively small vocabulary. And as a result, words can have any one of a number of different meanings. They're like trying to, you could liken it to trying to overhaul a car with a toolbox that's only got 10 tools in it. And you got to use that screwdriver for not only unscrewing screws, but prying things and spreading and opening cans and everything else. And so the Hebrew words really have to do a lot of work. And as a result, there can be sometimes ambiguities in interpretation. But usually the context will clear them up, and if not that, the general tenor always will. All right. The word of the Lord that came to Joel, the son of Pethuel. So here again, God's word came to him. It was a prophecy from the Lord. And it starts right out, verse 2, "Hear this, ye old men, and give ear, all the inhabitants of the land. Has this been in your days, or even in the days of your fathers?" And we're going to read in the subsequent verses, as we've seen in the outline, a graphic description of unparalleled destruction that was wrought by these locusts. And so he starts out by saying, look at this. Have you ever seen anything like this in your days, or even in the days of your fathers? And the implied answer is no. This is something that is so terrible that they cannot in recent memory recall anything like it. One could almost say to the Church of Jesus Christ, can you recall going through trials like the Church of Jesus Christ is going through now in your days, or even in the days of your fathers, even going back a ways? In other words, I believe that the demonic pressure has really been turned, the heat has really been turned up on the church. God has had to do it. In a sense, his hand has been forced. If he's going to get an army in shape to minister for him, they're going to have to go through some things in order to make the decisions that they need to make in order to give God the latitude to do what he needs to do in them. But of course, another fulfillment here in the church could be what's wrought by the enemy during the tribulation period on the church, when the holy city is trampled underfoot 42 months, and they have to buy of him gold tried in the fire because they were the unwise virgins and had not prepared for the bridegroom's coming. Old men in NAS and Rotherham as elders. And so, and I believe it's both are true. Elders in the sense of the leaders being appealed to, but elders in the physical sense. In fact, one often led to another. That's where the office originated, on the basis that those that have been around a little bit longer usually have a little more wisdom, and therefore the ones that would be more likely chosen to have leadership roles in the earlier church, Israeli government. So, both physically and spiritually. In other words, it's like God would appeal to the ministers and the leaders of the Church of Jesus Christ today and say, look around you. Look at how much more devastation, spiritually speaking. Everything can look calm and placid, of course, externally, because we're not wrestling flesh and blood, but principalities. And then he says, tell your children of it, and let your children tell their children, and their children another generation. So he says, this is going to be so terrible that it's going to be passed down three generations. They're going to be telling one another about it. Just like God told Israel to tell their sons about how he had plagued Egypt and how he had brought them out of Egypt with a mighty hand. And that was not just because it was nice bedtime stories for their children, but because their children hadn't witnessed those things. They hadn't been old enough, or some of them not even born at that time. And so they needed to know how God had judged that nation because of their sin and rebellion and resistance against the will of God, and how God had been gracious to Israel and brought them out with a mighty hand so that they could come into the same knowledge of God and obey the Lord and keep His covenant. Same thing here. They're telling them not just because, hey, this was really quite a time, so much as it was because of our sins, and God allowed the enemy to come in and we were really overrun. But when we repented, then God returned and left a blessing and restored and so forth. And so, in other words, so they could learn the principle. Like Paul told Timothy, continue in the doctrine, or he said, take heed unto thyself and unto the doctrine, for in so doing thou shalt save both thyself and them that hear thee. Tell your children, and let them tell their children, spiritually speaking, so that they can all hear the words of Spirit and life and be saved. Exodus 10:2 was the reference here. So in Egypt, and then they came out and they came into Canaan. They were to tell their children about Egypt. It was a reminder of their past. In Judah, it's more a warning of the future. Although they're looking back to the past and they're telling their kids and they're telling their kids of what happened here in Joel's day, yet it's a warning for the future. Remember, present desolation, future threat, as we see in Baxter's outline. In other words, so their children won't fall into the same kind of sin and have to therefore undergo the same kind of chastisements. You know, sooner or later we need to learn the lessons of history so that we're not doomed to repeat its failures. And I don't believe the fatalistic saying that we learn nothing from history at all, except that we learn nothing from history. I think that's a very fatalistic view. And I think that God's given man a free will. And the Bible is replete with historical lessons. I mean, that's basically what it is. And, you know, commandments and historical lessons. So if we can't learn anything from history, then why read the Bible? If we're not able to be changed by the power of God and by reading these things and taking heed to these warnings so that we don't have to go through what they went through, then we might as well just give up and, you know, go play in the sun or something, because there's no hope. But there is hope. Now, remember, Babylonian captivity isn't until 605. Here we're looking at 830 or 820 BC. So there's over two centuries here, about two and a quarter centuries approximately, before the Babylonian captivity fulfillment of this locust plague desolation. See, it's not just Armageddon, it's Babylonian captivity for Judah there first. Before that came about. So God was, even though He made it seem like it was around the corner, you read the book of Joel and it's like, wow, you're just waiting for the other shoe to drop. You know, the locusts have come in and they've just devastated the crops, and now what? But the now what didn't come for over 200 years. But the Bible is written that way. It's written to make His coming seemingly imminent, the judgment seemingly imminent, because that's what it takes for man to make the decisions that he needs to make. It takes a little bit of pressure there. It takes a little bit of suspense. And otherwise, man, you know, will just lollygag around making daisy chains under the oak tree, and he won't ever get anything done for God. And so he needs to feel that imminency, because man whose breath is in his nostrils is only one breath away from death at any point in time anyway, regardless of how many generations it would be till there's a, you know, a big catastrophe or something along that line. And so man needs to have that sense. So much mercy and long-suffering on the place of God, on the part of God, he gave them much space to repent after this book's warnings. Well, of course, he's warning the Church of Jesus Christ today in like manner, maybe not in like manner, but also warning them. But the tribulation isn't going to be tomorrow. You know, the rapture isn't tomorrow. It's not even next year. There's some time here still, if I read the prophetic calendar correctly. But sometimes it seems like it. God knows how to bring such conviction on a person that they feel like something bad's going to happen any minute. Like everything's just going to fall apart. They're going to die. Something bad's going to happen. This feeling of, you know, this foreboding feeling. The certain fearful looking for of judgment that the Bible talks about. But see, that's good. He does that for a purpose. To make them realize, hey, you are only one breath from eternity. So you better get your act together, as they say. And yet the, you know, tribulation didn't come the next day, like the person felt it was, like he was going to miss the rapture that night if he didn't jump out of bed, fall on his face, and repent. But see, he needed to experience that feeling in order to feel the dread of what it would be like to miss the rapture and to go into the tribulation. So God knows how to work all these things together. And there are warnings that he gives us, doesn't he? To let us know that someday it will come, and it will no longer just be seemingly empty threats and warnings, which of course aren't really empty. They're given in love and because of love. But one day it'll actually come. And then those who are ready will go, and those who aren't won't. Psalms 44:1 you can put here. All right, let's read verse 4. Here's the result of the desolation. That which the palmer worm has left has the locust eaten. That which the locust has left has the cankerworm eaten. And that which the cankerworm has left has the caterpillar eaten. So the locusts have come in and eaten and eaten and eaten and eaten in four successively severer stages. Now, looking at this in the English, you would surmise that there are four different varieties of insectidae that are devouring their crops. There's palmer worms, there's locusts, there's caterpillars, but really, in the Hebrew, it's talking about one kind of insect all the way through here. It's the locust. But it's four stages in the growth of the locust. You know, just like we can talk about infancy, you know, childhood, adolescence, and adulthood in the growth and development of a human being. Well, there are four stages in the growth and development of the locust. And they are given here in ascending order. So first of all, there was the first stage of the locust, and it devoured certain things. And this first stage he calls in the English the locust, but now the Hebrew actually is swarming locust. Oh, excuse me. What am I doing here? First one is palmer worm. I skipped down to number two. So let's just leave that. We'll make that number two. Here's number one right here, the palmer worm in the Hebrew is the gnawing locust, G-N-A-W-I-N-G. So this is in the springtime, early springtime, and the eggs have just hatched. And it's just emerged from the egg. It's very small. Doesn't have any wings yet, but of course it's got a voracious appetite. And so those little critters are walking across the land, and anything green that's in their path, chomp, chomp, chomp. And then number two we have, but they don't eat everything. But what they leave is now devoured by the locust in its second stage. Okay? So these, each stage is eating what the other one's left until finally, after the fourth one, there's nothing left. Now, the gnawing, the locust then, number two, so that which the palmer worm or the gnawing locust has left, the palmer worm eats. Or the locust eats. That which the palmer, that which the gnawing locust has left, the locust, or the Hebrew is swarming locust, see, it's locust in each case in the Hebrew. The swarming locust has eaten. So this is the same creature. It's the locust. But now it's late in spring. Now it's still in its first skin. It has not shed its skin for another one like it does. But and it's putting forth its offspring. It's already reproducing after its kind. And that's probably why the Hebrews, when they observed it, called it the swarming locust. Because all of the offspring, you know, being put forth, the eggs and so on, it looked, there was swarming activity. And so now it's devouring what the palmer worm had left. And then that which the locust or swarming locust has left has the cankerworm eaten. Now we have the third stage. Cankerworm in the Hebrew is licking locust. The licking locust. Now, this one has now, the locust, third stage, has now developed small wings, which enable it, it still can't fly yet, the wings are undeveloped, but the wings help it to leap farther, and they, as they flap their little undeveloped wings, they can stay in the air longer than they would otherwise when they would leap. So they can't fly yet, but they can sure leap, and which means what? They cover more ground. And therefore, the locust swarm, as it makes its way through the land, is covering more territory now as they devour. Much devouring, in fact, is accomplished in this third stage. But they don't eat everything. But that which the cankerworm or licking locust leaves has the caterpillar eaten. And the caterpillar, in the Hebrew, is the consuming locust. The consuming locust. All right, now it is a full adult. Stage four. It's got fully developed wings. This species of locust is about 3 inches in length. That's pretty long. You know, locust is related to the grasshopper, so just think, picture a grasshopper in your mind. But about 3 inches long. That's a pretty big grasshopper. And it's got 2 antennae, each an inch long, off the head. And it's the category of insect with 6 legs. Actually, that's one of the attributes of an insect, a 6-legged creature. And, of course, the 2 rear legs, being the longer articulated ones, very strong, which enable it to leap. Now, that's what was happening in the natural in Joel's day. As these things got developed, they were eating more and more and more in Judah. But it also represents something. Besides being an actual invasion of locusts upon Judah in Joel's day, and it clearly is that, it's not saying nothing was happening in Joel's day, this is just a prophecy. Because if that was the case, why would it be the word of the Lord that came to Joel for him to tell this generation, listen to this, verse 2, tell your children about it, verse 3, has anything been like this in your days or the days of your fathers, verse 2, they would look at him and say, been like what? Has what been like this? There's nothing, everything's going on the same. See, those words would mean nothing to his generation as he prophesied these, you know, before he ever wrote them down for us, they were prophesied. What would it mean if there was nothing there? And he tells the priests to gird themselves with sackcloth and lament, repent, chapter 1, verses 13 and 14. Now, why would he tell them that if there was no locust there? See, because the priests are the mediators between God and the nation, so they are repenting on behalf of the nation. Peradventure, God will be merciful and, you know, restore them and forgive and so forth. And then he tells the people in general. So first he talks to the elders. Has this been in your days? Chapter 1, verse 2. Then he talks to the priests. Gird yourselves, lament. Then he talks to the people in general. Chapter 2, verses 12 and 13. And he says, turn unto me, rend your heart and not your garment. So the point is that unless the nation repents, this locust invasion, as severe as it is, will be followed by a stronger and even more severe judgment, which eventually did happen. Remember, two centuries later, the Babylonian locust invasion, as it were. That army, this time not of insects but of human men, came in and invaded them and climbed over their walls, as it were, and devoured their crops, which they did, as they kept Jerusalem under an 18-month siege, shutting up the Jews inside the wall, great walled city, while they, and this was in the summer of 586 B.C., when the crops were coming to fruition. Well, it came all the way through, actually, spring, summer, that whole harvest time. And so the Babylonians were out there harvesting their crops in the fields and eating them, so that army has to have something to subsist on, you know. And the Jews ended up with tremendous famine inside the walled city, to the point where they even began to practice cannibalism before the thing was over. And so devouring was going on. There's all kinds of parallels there between the locust invasion and human beings. But then it didn't stop there. It's one of those multiple prophecies. We see the fulfillment in the Battle of Armageddon. And we'll see that it has to be there, ultimately, because God ends up saying all nations assembled against Judah and Jerusalem when we get into Joel 3. That's not Babylon. Babylon was not all nations. There were several nations involved because Babylon has previously subjugated other nations, some other nations, and conscripted their soldiers into their army. So they did fight under a number of different banners, but it wasn't all nations, and it wasn't a devastation to the degree that God is here describing it. So that's why we know it's reserved for the last days in that great last battle. Now, there is kind of got ahead of myself with that, but maybe I didn't. Let me check here. All right, so it's prophetic. It's an invasion of locusts in Joel's day, number one. Physical, natural, really, it happened. But then number two, it does represent nations of men devouring Judah at some future time. Because, and I gave you two fulfillments. There may even be more. One being the Babylonian captivity, and two being the Battle of Armageddon. So those are subheadings to that. And we know that this is the case because we know that it's got to refer to some future judgments and not just things that happened in Joel's day, because the symbols that he uses, the terminology, the terms that he uses in these prophecies, and the time keys, the prophetic time keys that you find in them, those three things are parallel to the symbols used and the terms used and the time keys found in other prophetic scriptures that are clearly Battle of Armageddon scriptures, in which there's no question. So it's by analogy that we prove, and by comparison, that these are Battle of Armageddon prophecies, end time prophecies. And when we move into chapter 3, it'll become indisputable. It's a little more vague in chapter 1, gets a little clearer in chapter 2. Time you get to chapter 3, he's even dropped the locust metaphor entirely, and he's talking about men doing this, beating swords into plowshares, or plowshares into swords, excuse me, and pruning hooks into spears, and let the weak say I'm strong, and so forth. It's men he's talking, referring to, not locusts. But now, some have wondered, well, number 4, is this to be taken literally or figuratively? If we take it figuratively, then it's that which is universal. And so it could just be prophetic of a universal judgment that is coming. Because remember, the Battle of Armageddon, technically speaking, is part of the plagues, isn't it? Or it's during that plague period, and in which God is inflicting judgments upon the whole world, pouring vials of wrath out upon the earth. And it's the sixth trumpet of the seventh seal that constitutes the Battle of Armageddon. And so a universal judgment upon man for his sin. But if we take it in a physical sense, then you have to say, well, what four nations have devoured Judah in order to see the four stages of the locust which the locust prefigure? Well, some have guessed, number one, Babylonians. Certainly they did come in. and ruin the land and take many captives and so forth, as I've said. Number two, the Syrians. Now this came later during what we call the intertestamental period, or the so-called 400 silent years, under the reign of the Seleucids, S-E-L-E-U-C-I-D-S. And the worst one of this era was, of course, Antiochus Epiphanes. Number three, or third stage, could perhaps be the Romans, who, of course, the Jewish-Roman wars in A.D. 66 to 70, which culminated with the Jews being driven out of Rome, the Zealot uprising being crushed, according to some figures, some 2 million Jews being slain, and another 1 million Jews being slain later on, with, you know, Jerusalem being destroyed and the temple burned and so forth, and which Jesus prophesied of. And then number four, the consuming locust in its fully developed adult stage. Remember, Paul talked about the mystery of iniquity working, you know, and then it's the, but then shall that man of lawlessness be revealed. There's this locust will come to an adult mature form, as it were. The plan of mystery of iniquity will be culminated, of course, in the one world government under the man of lawlessness, probably Satan incarnate in the Antichrist. And so the Antichrist, who is the one that marshals all of those nations to come against Israel in the Battle of Armageddon, would be number four, the Battle of Armageddon under the Antichrist, where they make the land a desolate wilderness. Now, you say, what? I thought it was Egypt, Assyria, Medo-Persia, or Babylonia, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. Greece, the Seleucid eras during what we call the when Greece was ruling. So we've got that one. We've got Babylon. We've got Rome. What about Assyria? What about Medo-Persia? You have to leave those two out. And it's not necessarily shoehorning to do so, because Assyria took Israel, the northern kingdom, captive. And Joel here is talking about more about Judah. So maybe that's why we don't have to try to find room for Assyria. And Medo-Persia, they didn't really devastate and come in at all. All they did was overthrow Babylon and just kind of come into place as ruler over the Gentiles here. In fact, it was a Medo-Persian king, Cyrus, that made the decree to let the Jews come back to their land and rebuild their temple. Now, they did tax the people, you know, during that time and so forth, but that probably wouldn't be severe enough to be, you know, an anti-type of locust invasion, just taxing them and so forth. So Medo-Persia probably doesn't fit in here either. Now, I don't necessarily think it's an either-or situation. You know, is it these four nations or is it four universal? I think it's both, because one encompasses the other. Because number four, the Antichrist nations at the Battle of Armageddon, like I just got through saying, is part of the universal plagues being poured out upon the earth. It's a localized manifestation of the judgment of God, you might say. Now, we would be remiss if we did not also see in Joel's prophecies the applications to the church, to the spiritual Judah, spiritual Jews. And so here we see prophecies of end time pressure upon the Church of Jesus Christ, that is in the same time as the preparation and ministry of the man-child company, who will deal a death blow to the Antichrist kingdom. And so we're going to make some of those parallels for you as we go along. Satan has fought the work of God from the very beginning. And so and particularly in the church, ever since Jesus Christ, you don't see demons manifest in the Old Testament, but when Jesus came ministering, they're crying out of people and manifesting and coming out of the woodwork. For this cause was the Son of God manifested, that he might destroy the works of the enemy. So more, even more so, since during the times of the church history, from early church history to now, it might be an interesting thesis to explore as to whether you can see four distinct stages. Now, we know there's seven ages, church ages, but within the seven ages might lie four stages of successively severe persecution, not just externally, because otherwise you're going to turn it around, reverse it, when you see the tremendous early church persecution, but spiritually as well. And another way to look at it would be maybe from the time of Adam on up to the end of time. There may be four stages. I'm not dogmatic on this, but it's a possibility. One thing I am dogmatic on, and that is that there is a fuller development of the plan of Satan to try to thwart the plan of God as time goes on. And again, it becomes more manifest in the end of time. Just like time, these are 3-inch long locusts, it's pretty obvious what's going on. When they're little tiny gnawing locusts, they're not eating as much, they're smaller, maybe they don't seem to pose much of a threat. But by the time they're adults, they do. And so it is with the mystery of iniquity. After a while, it's revealed, it's manifest, it's clear, it's open, it's obvious. Paul said, in the last days, perilous times shall come, and evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse. 2 Timothy 3, 1 and 13. Now, some have wondered if the locusts in the book of Joel are the same as the locusts that are described in Revelation chapter 9. Now, I don't know what Jeff teaches on this. I should probably check with him some year, but I don't think that they're the same. And the reason that I don't is as follows. The locusts that are seen in Revelation chapter 9 are part of the plagues, per se. Which, you know, I said Armageddon is part of the plagues. Now I'm going to turn around and make it sound like I'm contradicting myself, but I'm not. If you understand what I mean, the plagues are that which is poured out upon the entire earth or large sections of it from heaven. But then we call it after the plagues that there's this battle of Armageddon, which culminates in the second coming. Okay, so the plagues are coming, being poured out. They're the earlier trumpets or vials that occur before the battle of Armageddon. And so when you look in Revelation 9 and you see the time element for those locusts, the time element is the fifth trumpet or vial, or first woe, of the seventh seal. Okay, so it's during the plagues. Whereas the battle of Armageddon, which is what is prefigured, prophesied of here in Joel, is the sixth trumpet, or vial, or second woe. Sixth trumpet, or sixth vial, or second woe, of the seventh seal, which is a later time element. And so the apocalypse is locusts come one trumpet before, or vial before Joel's locusts, and therefore I don't feel that they refer to the same thing. The ones in the book of Revelation are most likely not men. They're most likely demons who are given authority by God to torment men for 5 months. The locusts in the book of Joel are basically men. Now, granted, demonized men, but men who assemble this tremendous army and come down against Jerusalem to battle. So it's demons in Revelation, it's men in Joel, prophesied of by these locusts. So here we have these judgments executed little by little, progressively severer, with time for space for repentance, time and space for repentance in between. Now, this phenomenon of locust plagues or locust invasions is not as rare as you might think. In other words, it's not that the only time it's ever happened in the history of man was right here. It has happened on a number of occasions in various times and climes. Let me give an example. In Palestine, in 1915, so this is in our century now, 1915 A.D., in Palestine, and that was when it was under British mandate, before they were given their nationhood status in 1948, there was a locust invasion, and it was described as follows. And don't try to get this down, but just listen to it. This is one account of it. He says, a loud noise was heard before the locusts were seen, produced by the flapping of myriads of locust wings and resembling the distant rumbling of waves. Have you ever been to the beach, of course, all of you, and you've heard the crashing, you know, rumbling sound before you ever maybe got over the crest of the hill there and saw the ocean. You heard it and you knew it was there. And so all of these millions or billions of wings flapping at once even though they're little tiny wings on a little 3-inch insect, the sound of it all together was a huge rumble and a roar like waves. It had to be a frightening thing to hear that sound and to look around and wonder what's happening before you ever see it fly over. He said the sun was suddenly darkened. So here they are walking along in Palestine one day, minding their own business, 1915. And all of a sudden, they hear this rumble, and then they fly over, and it's like a big cloud has all of a sudden obscured the sun. And he says, showers of their excrements fell thick and fast, resembling those of mice. So it was raining locust excrement all over them. He says their elevation above the earth was at times hundreds of feet. At other times, they flew quite low, detached numbers alighting. In Jerusalem, at least, Mr. Whiting said, they inevitably came from the northeast, going toward the southwest, establishing the accuracy of Joel's account in chapter 2, verse 20. And that's where he calls it the northern army, coming down from the north. Of course, there that's Battle of Armageddon that he's talking about there, but it fits with apparently the pattern of the locusts generally coming in from that direction. Maybe the wind, maybe usually there's a wind from the north, northerly wind that would bring them in, because they do come in on the wind currents. Then he says, tons of locusts were captured and buried alive. Many were thrown into cisterns or into the Mediterranean Sea, and when washed ashore, were collected and dried and used for fuel in Turkish baths. So they had, can you imagine tons? How many locusts would it take to make a ton? Well, I'll tell you how much a locust weighs in a minute, and if you've got a scientific slide rule or a calculator, you can work it out. Continuing, he says, the government issued a proclamation, in the British Mandate government there, in April 1915, requiring every man from the ages of 16 to 60 to gather 11 pounds of locust eggs daily and deliver them to the officials. Now how many, and locust eggs, little tiny pinpoint, like a head of a straight pin, how many of those would it take to make 11 pounds? And if there's, and I don't know what the population of Palestine was in 1915, but if it's even just a few tens of thousands of men, each one times 11 pounds of eggs per day that they had to find in order to keep them, those things from hatching and then, you know, just causing this to continue. He says the stork was especially numerous over Palestine in 1915, and greedily devoured the innumerable host of the locust pest. Hens gorged themselves on them. Can you imagine these storks trying to get back up in the air after eating, you know, pounds and pounds of locusts and locust eggs? Mr. Aronson, another witness of the plague in 1915, testifies that in less than 2 months after their first appearance, not only was every green leaf devoured, but the very bark was peeled from the trees, which stood out white and lifeless, like skeletons. The fields, he says, were stripped to the ground. Even Arab babies left by their mothers in the shade of some tree had their faces devoured before their screams were even heard. The natives accepted the plague as just judgment because of their wickedness. Now that's rather interesting, that they, you know, somehow they sense this has to be the judgment of God, just like it was back in the day of Joel. And I can't say whether it was or not, but they at least felt that. Now, the book of Maccabees, which covers some of the intertestamental history of Judah, also describes a locust invasion, if I remember right. And I thought to bring that, and I didn't bring it today. I've got an edition of it at home, but we've got it in the library too, I think. So if you want these references, if you want to look them up, it's 2 Maccabees 5:15 and chapter 6. Verses 1 and 2 through 6, and chapter 10, verses 1 through 5. I usually read that. Now, here's a more recent article. I got this one. That other one, I think, was from the Reader's Digest, seems like. I don't remember now. But this one, I can credit to the Seattle Times, June the 15th, 1978. So this is less than 10 years old. And it's a brief article, but the title is Aid Sought in Battle Against Locusts, UPI. Hordes of locusts are ravaging crops from East Africa to India, raising the specter of mass starvation in underdeveloped and already undernourished countries. Agriculture officials in stricken nations have pleaded for immediate aid to wipe out the insects before they spread to up to 50 other nations from Morocco to the Himalayas. The Desert Locust Control Organization for Eastern Africa, where the swarms have caused the worst damage so far, called a meeting in Rome next week to solicit and coordinate international aid. So there's you're seeing part of the northeastern tip of Africa right there on that map, with Libya, Egypt, and Ethiopia. John Malasila, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, chairman of the organization and Tanzania's agriculture minister, said locusts devour at least 8,400 tons of crops a day. 8,400 tons of crops a day. Malasila said a recent inspection of afflicted areas of Kenya, Somalia, and Ethiopia found at least 60 swarms of locusts, 60 separate swarms, each ranging from 10 to 40 square miles in size. Now think about that. 10 to 40 square miles. I don't know how many square miles metropolitan Seattle is or Seattle city limits. I don't know. I try to give you some kind of a feel for what 10 to 40 square miles is, but believe me, it's a huge area. And one of those swarms could be that big, and there were 60 of them. He says a million people in those areas already face starvation because the drought wiped out the barley crop. So first no rain, and so they lose their barley crop. Then whatever comes after the barley, the wheat or whatever, the locusts come in and take it. You know what? Hold those Maccabees references. I looked at the wrong symbol on my page here, and those are going to go to a later verse. Those Maccabees references, I didn't think that was right. I had two triangles there, and I looked at the wrong one. That actually is going to go to chapter 1, verse 9, so apologize for that. Here's some miscellaneous facts on locusts for your almanac. The adult locust eats daily the equivalent of its own weight, just like birds. Well, birds, I think, even eat up to two or three times their weight. But the locust eats equivalent of its own weight, which isn't that much. And here's its weight. The weight is from between 0.04 to 0.09 of an ounce. 0.04 to 0.09 ounces each. Not very big. 0.04 to 0.09 of an ounce. The locust, if needs be, can live up to 4 days without any food by surviving on stored fat. So when they're flying from one crop to another, they can live off their stored fat. That's the last bell. I guess I'll just have to hold here, and I'll give you a few more before we get back into this when we come back next week. Here's a little cartoon that somebody gave me 1 year. It's from Punch magazine, July 23rd, 1980, and I don't need to really pass it around, but you can just see it's a cartoon depiction of this land covered with locusts. And there's a close-up here of two locusts. One's talking to the other, and he says, "Okay, that's settled then. Breakfast in Egypt, lunch in Libya, and dinner in Algeria." Probably not very funny for the people that are there, but